Also, I'd like to encourage those of you who aren't members of this venerable organization to consider joining. And I say venerable because this rather unusual town gown institution has been going since 1916, with pretty good audiences coming out even on terribly rotten Saturday nights to hear a whole panorama of subjects. Anyway, there are forms at the entrance, and if you feel moved to join, your dues help us to keep bringing some outstanding thinkers from around the world to come to speak to us, so please consider joining. I want to remind you that, as always, there'll be a question period after the talk, so if you want to ask a question, you'll probably have a chance to. Also, as you saw, if you came in time, our next two speakers next week is Dr. Quentin Cronker, who's the director of the UBC Botanical Gardens, and then Joe Schlesinger, who will be familiar to, I think, everybody in the audience. Our speaker, Carl Wyman, grew up in Oregon, but went west to MIT for his degree in science. He saw the light and returned to the West Coast for his doctorate degree at Stanford in 1977. And then, for about almost the last 20 years, he's now been at the University of Colorado, where he's distinguished professor of physics and a fellow of the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics. Dr. Wyman's research has been in laser spectroscopy, and his work has helped to understand and indeed circumvent many of the practical and fundamental limitations of techniques for cooling and trapping of atoms. The work he did went on to involve combining optical and magnetic trapping, and as a result, it became possible to cool atoms sufficiently to attain a Bose-Einstein condensation in a vapor. An unprecedented landmark occurred when his team was able to cool a grass sample almost to absolute zero. Now, I think after his talk, most of us will have a better grasp of the significance of this achievement and how it has opened up an important and a new subfield of physics. Dr. Wyman has received so many honors that it wouldn't leave much time for his talk if I were to recite them all. So I'm just going to mention half a dozen. He's received the E.O. Lawrence Prize in Physics, the Davison-Germer Award for Atomic Physics, the King Faisal International Prize for Science, the Franklin Medal, the Einstein Medal for Laser Science, and the Lorentz Medal. His most recent award, of course, was the Nobel Prize in Physics. I'd like you to welcome our speaker, whose talk is on Bose-Einstein condensation, quantum weirdness at the lowest temperature in the universe, Dr. Wyman.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. They assured me that there would be several hundred people coming out on a Saturday night to listen to a physics lecture, and I have to say, I really did not believe it, no matter how many times they told me, but so it's nice to see all of you. Do I need that off? Okay, fine. Okay, so what I'm going to tell you about is work that we've done, we being a team led by Eric Cornell and myself with many students and over the years, to make this strange new form of matter called Bose-Einstein condensate, which was predicted by Einstein in 1924, and then in 1995, we finally got things cold enough for it to show up. And so the first part of my talk, and really the majority of the talk, will be really what this is and how we go about making it. But then I'm going to spend a little bit of time at the end talking about some recent research, just to give you a little flavor of the kind of interesting things and discoveries, and we're able to do with this right now. So this is all about, here, I need some more light, sorry. So this is all about getting things very cold, and so the first thing we need to do is remind you what temperature is the way I think about temperature. Unfortunately, I've got animations to do that. So if you take a bunch of atoms and you put them in a container, like, you know, the atoms in the room here in a gas, they're just little tiny balls zinging around inside. They're bouncing off the walls and each other. And the temperature is really just a measure of how much speed they have, how fast they're going. And so when you go to cool things, what you're really doing is slowing those atoms down. And so if you think about temperature this way, you realize that there's only there's a limit on how slow you can make something. And that means there's also a limit on how cold you can make it. And this is where all the atomic motion stops. That's what we physicists call absolute zero. And to put this on a scale that you can appreciate, well, maybe you can't appreciate it. I forgot to change Fahrenheit into centigrade. Sorry. So we live up here at about 300 in Kelvin units. And a degree Kelvin is the same as a degree centigrade, by the way. And so in our experiments, we're working down here very close to absolute zero. And it's kind of interesting to realize that the Bose-Einstein condensation owes its existence entirely to people. It can never occur in nature. And the reason I say that is because we know the coldest spot in nature. It's, you know, deep in intergalactic space. And we can look out there, and we can see that it's 3 degrees above absolute zero. And that's actually millions of times too hot for a Bose condensate to form. And so, like I say, it just cannot ever occur in nature. It can only exist because scientists like Bose and Einstein figured out the laws of physics, allowed it to exist. And then over the years, many people worked on figuring out how to get things colder and colder until we could actually achieve what was required to make it. Now, one of the nice features about the fact that we can get things so much colder than nature is that we get to make the somewhat grandiose claim that our laboratory here, which sits in Boulder, this is Boulder, Colorado, is the coldest spot in the universe. At least until someone comes from another planet and tells us otherwise. But in fact, this isn't about, and never was really about, just trying to get things cold. It was to get them cold enough to make this fascinating new kind of matter. And to really appreciate what that is, you need a brief course in quantum physics. So for those of you who are quantum physics may be a little rusty, I'll give you a little brush up here. If you take a bunch of atoms and you put them in a container, they fly around in there, you know, like little tiny balls. But in fact, if those atoms are in any reasonable temperature, under any conditions, those atoms actually can't have any possible energy or any possible speed they want. The laws of quantum physics say there's only certain allowed speeds they can be moving, and there are little jumps between them. If they want to go higher, they can't smoothly increase their speed. They have to go in little jumps. But the jumps between the allowable speeds are so incredibly tiny that in any normal condition, normal size container, even with the most sophisticated instruments, you could never measure that those actually little discrete jumps between what's allowed. However, if you get things very cold, then something unusual happens. And this was actually first pointed out by Einstein. He was extending the work of Bose and way back in 1924. And what Einstein noticed was looking at the equations, if you got the atoms colder, very, very cold, less than a millionth of a degree above absolute zero, then as they get them colder, their quantum waviness, if you've ever heard of something called the de Broglie wavelength, their quantum waviness gets bigger and bigger. And if you get them so cold that the quantum wave of one atom starts overlapping the quantum wave of the atom next to it, then what Einstein noticed the equation said was that some sort of strange lemming-like sense, all the atoms would decide to jump down here into the very lowest possible speed or very lowest possible energy in that container, and they would all go together. And this is what we call Bose-Einstein condensation, and the temperature scale for this is down at this sort of 100 billionths of a degree above absolute zero. Now, it's actually kind of surprising that Einstein really missed all the significance of this. He had no real physical insight about what was happening. He just looked at equations and said, gee, they predict this funny thing happens. I wonder if there's any, you know, anything real about it. And he missed it was many years later, other physicists came along who really appreciated the importance of this, and the importance was really the nature of this material that you would get if you had all the atoms come into this into the same energy state. And what's special about it is all the atoms, they actually lose their identities as individual atoms, and they sort of fuse together into a single giant quantum wave, or sometimes called a super atom. And this material, and this was all predicted well before we started our work, would have very unique properties that you'd have a large collection of atoms, something big enough to see, which had its behavior was completely governed by these strange laws of quantum physics, which physicists have known about for a long time, but you can only sense them indirectly because they're buried down at the submicroscopic level. It was really the prospect of trying to make this material with these predicted very exotic characteristics that motivated our work. So let me start telling you now about how we went about getting atoms cold enough, in other words, slow enough to actually get Bose condensation. And one of the things that made this experiment fun was that it, unlike most physics, forefront physics research these days, which uses very large facilities, like Triumph and many, many people, this actually is a relatively small, simple, cheap experiment. And the heart of it, you can see right here, is just a little glass cell. It's 2.5 centimeters on a side. And we pump all the air molecules out of here so they don't bump into the atoms we want to cool and heat them up. And we put in a few rubidium atoms. That's the kind of atom we want to cool, and they're bouncing around inside here. And then we send in laser beams here and I'll explain what they're used for. They're the red things are sent into this cell. And the blue and green things here, those are just coils of wire. And we run current through those, and I'll show you how that works. But so the whole heart of the thing is just about the size of my fist. And you can see it's not really very much to it. Now, in fairness, I should say this is the artist's conception of what the apparatus looks like. This is the graduate student realization of it. But you can see the glass cell in here. You can see all these coils of wire around it that you saw before. And you've got mirrors and so on for bouncing laser beams through it, like I described before. And it's actually not, it's relatively simple and cheap by big modern physics standards, but it's not all that simple. It's sitting here in the middle of this table down here, but this is what we characterize as tabletop physics, but you can see it's getting to be a pretty cluttered table. But nevertheless, it is, the scale is, you know, you can see I've got a postdoc and two graduate students here, and they build all this stuff and run it. Oh, I guess there's one other point you can get from this, if, at least particularly if you're a student. If you've ever wondered, this should erase all doubts as to that the Nobel Prize Selection Committee gives no points, no extra credit for neatness in there. Okay, so how do we use that apparatus for getting these atoms very cold? Well, it turns out the first step is we shine light on them. Now, this should seems very strange that you can get something cold by shining light on it. You know, if you go out into the sunlight, you know, the sun shines on you and you get hot, not cold. Actually, judging by my experiences in Vancouver so far, take my word, you may have never seen the sun. But take my word for it, if it does ever come out, you get hot. So how can you get something cold by shining light on it? Well, the trick is that when the sunlight shines on you, you absorb all that energy and it goes and stays in you. Whereas when we shine light on the atoms, we make sure the light bounces off them. And you can understand this, well, I'll start with this, is that light comes in little chunks, which we call photons, and those come in and bounce off an atom, which compared to a little chunk of light is a big, fat, heavy thing. And I can show this better here. And so what you've got is you send the laser beam, and each time one of these little chunks of light bounces off it, it gives it a little kick. And the great thing about lasers, you get a lot of light out of them. And so you can get this atom with a whole lot of kicks. And each time it gets a kick, it's really much the same as throwing table tennis balls at a bowling ball. You know, each one just gives a little nudge, but if there are many, many of them hitting, it can be a big force that pushes it around rather vigorously. So this really is the basic force that we use for cooling these atoms off, is just bouncing these little chunks of light off them. Now, you should wonder, though, because this, you know, is all going in one direction. So yeah, I can push this atom, but only in one direction. To cool something, you need to have atoms going all different directions and slow all of them down. And so to do that, we build what's something called optical molasses. And so now here is really an animation of what's happening inside that glass cell. So imagine this is the glass cell. Here are my rubidium atoms zipping through. Of course, the real ones move much faster and are much smaller, but the basic models, much like shown here. And we've got laser beams now coming in from each direction, so actually all six directions. And when the atoms come through these laser beams, right now, the light's very red. The atom just ignores it. None of the light bounces off the atoms at all. There's no effect at all. And that's because each atom sort of has a favorite color. And here that's shown at this peak right here. And unless you're very close to that favorite color, then the light just ignores the atoms and vice versa. So now I'm way down here, too red for the atom. Jump up here, I'm way too green for it. But now, let me start getting closer to the favorite color here, and you can start to see now something's happening, that the atoms are speeding up. And the reason they're speeding up is because of something called the Doppler shift. It's a difference in whether the light is going along the same direction as the atom or going in the opposite direction of the atom. And so in how it bounces off it. So obviously, we don't want to speed them up. So we carefully adjust the laser to be just slightly to the red side of the rubidium atom's favorite color. And now, as the rubidium atom comes through the laser beams, the light that's opposing its motion is always the light that bounces off preferentially off the atoms. And so that slows them down, and they get stuck here in the middle of these intersecting laser beams. And so you can see optical molasses is a rather good name for this. You can picture this much like, you know, running in a hailstorm. If there's no wind and there's a big hailstorm, it doesn't matter what direction you run, the hail hits you in the face, and so you want to stop. And it's much the same with our atoms. The light hits them in the face no matter what direction they're going, so they stop. And that means they're cold. Now, when we first started doing this, we were really copying other people's work on cooling atoms with light, but we're just playing around trying to do it really cheap. We were showing we could do this with laser beams, lasers much like in a CD player or in this laser pointer, and so instead of lasers that cost $250,000, we could do it with lasers that cost $100. So that was, you know, just kind of fun to do and demonstrate. But in fact, it worked very well, and we tried this with our cheap lasers, and we discovered that not only did it work very inexpensively, but the atoms were very cold. They were the coldest, down about 10 millionths of a degree above absolute zero, and at that time, which was way back in the late 80s, that was the coldest temperature anyone had ever achieved. And so, you know, that was fun and exciting. But being good scientists, we didn't spend very much time celebrating. We very soon started asking ourselves, well, okay, so they're about 10 millionths of a degree above absolute zero. That's pretty nice. But what's the physics that makes them that temperature? Why aren't they hotter? Why aren't they colder? And so we started studying that, and it actually ended up taking us a couple of years to understand it. But the most important process is one that's pretty simple. It turns out that the photons of light here, they're a little bit like house guests. You know how house guests are, most of the time, they're very nice to have when they first show up. You're delighted to have them there. But if they hang around too long, then they start to get distinctly unpleasant, right? If they're there after much longer than you really hope they'd stay. And our light does that because the way it can hang around is it comes in here and it's bouncing off all these atoms all the time, and it starts bouncing back and forth between the different atoms in this cold sample. And if you have very good eyes and you're in the front row, you may be able to see these are jiggling around a little bit because of the light particles bouncing between them. Of course, each time a particle of light bounces off the atom, jostles it around. And this is actually, jiggling around means they're moving, it means they have temperature, and this determines the temperature of these atoms. So once we realized this, we started realizing, well, we need to, so if we want to do more with these atoms, get them colder, we need to get rid of the light. And so it turns out it's a lot easier to get rid of lasers than light than it is house guests. You just stick your hand in the light beam. The trouble is that these atoms are moving very slowly at this temperature. They're moving about this fast. And if you turn off the laser light that was really holding them up, they fall just like anything else does that's moving this fast. When you let go of it, it just falls, you know, thud, and hits the bottom of our little glass cell and heats up again, and the experiment's over. Although it doesn't make nearly that loud a noise. So we need some way, we've used the laser light to get them nice and cold, we need some way to keep them around. And you need some way to keep them around, to hold them, that's very gentle so it doesn't heat them back up. And that's where those blue and green coils of wire come in. Because if you have a coil of wire and you run an electric current through it, it makes a magnetic field. And each of these little rubidium atoms is a little tiny magnet. And so that, you know, that a magnet can push on another magnet. And so if you make those coils the right shape and you run the right amount of current through them, you can hold the atoms just with the magnetic forces. And so really call what we call a magnetic bowl. And so you're now holding these atoms very gently just with the magnetic field, not touching any real material inside the center of that little glass cell without the light on now. And it turns out this works very well, and it keeps these atoms very cold. It's like an incredibly good thermos bottle. The atoms stay there, and they just don't heat up at all. And that inspired us to then start looking for ways to cool them even farther. In fact, at this point, we were close enough to this sort of mythical limit of what you needed for Bose-Einstein condensation, we decided we should make a serious effort to try and achieve it. And so the way to cool these, so we develop a way to cool these atoms farther that are in this magnetic bowl. And they've been sort of pre-cooled by the laser beams. And that's called evaporative cooling. And all of you probably have seen evaporative cooling in action. When you have a cup of coffee and you've got steam coming off, the steam is really the most energetic coffee molecules leaping out of the cup, and they take away more than their share of the energy. And because they take away more than their share, the atoms that are left behind end up colder, and that's why your coffee cools off. And so if you want to see one benefit of fundamental physics research, you now know that even if you don't have an insulated cup, if you go home and put a lid on your coffee cup, it will cool off much, much slower and stay hot for a longer time. So that's your main benefit from this lecture. Okay, but how do we use this? As well as knowing how to keep our coffee warm, we use it for this exact same basic physics for cooling off these atoms that we've dumped into, turned off the laser light, dumped them into our magnetic bowl, and now we just let the most energetic ones get out the top of the bowl. And so you can see them escaping here. And as they do, the others have less energy and they're moving slower, they're settling down here to the bottom, their temperature is coming down here. But you can also see that it stops cooling after a while because there are no more atoms with enough energy to escape here. And that's the physics, which you were probably wondering about, of why your coffee doesn't cool down to absolute zero. It's because no more coffee molecules can escape. But what we can do with our magnetic bowl that you can't do with your coffee cup is we can slowly lower the sides of this magnetic bowl, and so that as it gets colder and colder, we can continually let the most energetic atoms still escape, and the temperature continues to go down. Now, I should say that to give you a scale for the experiment, it takes a few seconds for the atoms to get stuck in the optical molasses, and to cool them off by evaporative cooling, it takes about twice as long as this little game takes. It takes about a minute as a time scale for this. And the running the experiment is just like playing this game, that if you go down too slowly, well, if you go down too fast, you can see that a lot of atoms would escape right away and you wouldn't have anything left. If you go down too slowly, it gets boring and also bad other things in the real experiment happen. And so the graduate students spent a great deal of time very carefully adjusting the knobs on the computer, lowers this down at just the optimum rate so they can get the highest score, namely the most atoms left, when it gets down to this this temperature to go undergo Bose-Einstein condensation. So, by the way, all these things are on the web, so you can go home and play with them yourself and see if you can beat my score if you want. Okay, so that is the process. You know, you've just seen how to actually make a Bose-Einstein condensate. What I haven't shown you is how to see it. It doesn't really look like that in real life. So let me explain how we actually observe it. So what we've got is we've cooled these things down. It's just a little tiny cloud of gas held by this magnetic forces sitting in the middle of this glass cell. And we look at it by basically taking a shadow snapshot of it. We turn on a little pulse of laser light here. The laser light comes in and it hits the atoms. The atoms absorb the laser and make a shadow in the laser beam. And we image that beam, we image that shadow onto basically just a fancy television camera over here. And we've got this shadow tells us the shape of what the little cloud was. Now, if you're worrying about what the effect of that laser light is on these very cold atoms, I can assure you the effect is utterly catastrophic. It blows them away to pieces, but we can take a picture very quickly, and so we get an image, what the image really looked like before or what the cloud looked like before it got blown to pieces. And then you have to study it again, you got to make another new sample and look at it. So here are three different shadow pictures. Now, we've dressed these up a lot. We've colorized them artificially. They're really just black and white shadows. And this third dimension here is the darkness of the shadow, which is the same as the density of the sample. So here we've made a sample, we've evaporatively cooled it down to, this is 400 billionths of a degree above absolute zero, and you can see it's just sort of this gentle hill, which means it's kind of not a very dark shadow and pretty spread out. But the big excitement was then when we cooled down a little farther. We lowered the magnetic sides of the magnetic pole a little farther down to 200 billionths of a degree, and then suddenly we saw this narrow spire showing up on top of this gentle hill. And if we go even farther, lowering it down, cooling it more, in fact, we're left with nothing but the atoms in this spire here. And this is basically Bose-Einstein condensation. And I'll explain why in just a moment. I'll just point out that, just so you can picture what this really looks like, this is really then a little dark shadow, a very small, small spatial size, very dark shadow in the middle of a larger diffuse cloud. And so it's sort of like having a pit suddenly appear in the middle of a cherry, although it's actually more like having a cloud of water vapor and you cool it down until it starts to condense into a little drop in the center, a dense, little small dense region of more water. And that's why it's called condensation. It really is, it's rather analogous that way to just a little droplet of water forming. Now, why is it clear that this was both condensation? The answer is you can understand this just from the explanation I already gave you, namely, if these all go down into this lowest possible speed that they can have in this container, then they're all piled up right down here in the bottom, and so they're much much more localized and much denser that way than the rest of the atoms in the sample, which haven't condensed, which are have, you know, energy to go up the sides of the container and much more spread out. Now, I should say, just from the, you know, to give a little perspective on the, you know, scientific background here, that this was a very different experiment than most. Most physics experiments, most experiments of any kind, when you're working on something, you know, you spend a long time trying to build an apparatus that does what you find it needs to do, and you build a lot of things that don't work. I sort of, between the animations, between the next to the last and last animation, was actually 5 years of work with trying a lot of things that didn't work, and so I sort of oversimplified it a little bit. But once we built this apparatus that we thought was supposed to make, you know, supposed to achieve the conditions we thought were necessary, and we turned it on. I'm getting distracted here. What a typical experiment's like is that you try it and you don't see anything, and you twiddle with the knobs and fuss with it for a while and find a few things that aren't working. And then there's maybe some tiny little hint of a signal, and you fiddle with it for another few more weeks or months, and it gets a little bigger and a little bigger. And after a while, you know, even other people might even believe it's a real signal. And then after maybe a year more of that, you got something you can actually write scientific papers and publish on. And whereas in this experiment, we had sort of been after this for many years, and it really wasn't even clear that it could exist. The laws of physics were such that until we saw it, there were reasons to think it might disappear before you could ever observe it. And so, anyway, we built this apparatus and we turned it on, and this just jumped out with this giant peak just like this, exactly bigger than we'd ever hoped we'd ever see immediately. And so it was, no, it's just a lot more fun when you don't have to, you know, no delayed gratification. We could celebrate right away. Actually, we did spend a few days because it was too good to be true. And usually when that happens, you've made a mistake. And so we spent quite a while, actually, or several days, thinking of a whole bunch of tests that we could do really to make certain we weren't just deluding ourselves, and then we could celebrate. But okay, so I told you that the whole point of trying to make this stuff was these wonderful exotic properties it has. And, you know, I don't want to take the time to go into all the detailed technical experiments we've done looking at these to demonstrate this. I want to give you one very dramatic graphic example. This actually comes from some other people working in this, but it's this is taking one little blob of condensate and adding a second little blob on top of it and looking at it. Now, this is here's a picture of a condensate. Now, you know, I said this was big. It's big by atom standards, but it's getting up close to human size scale. It's about the width of a human hair, so it's big enough a person can see this. So you've got the little blob of condensate floating here, and now I'm going to stick another little blob on top of it. Now, we know what happens if you take one little blob of gas and you put another, you know, not very dense gas mixed in with it, you know, because here in the room we've got nitrogen and oxygen, and they just happily run around and pretty much ignore each other. But what happens when we take one blob of condensate, we put another on top of it and look at it? It shows this very strange pattern that there were a bunch of atoms where this is dark now. They're atoms that were there and there. You know, they aren't there anymore. So you might think, well, somehow putting that second blob there, you know, exerted forces and pushed them away or something. But then you look at the numbers, and in fact, this is an incredibly dilute gas. It's about a million times less dense than the air in the room here. There really aren't any forces pushing around at all. And so that's not what's happening. In fact, what's really happening is these atoms that were here and here, they don't exist there anymore. And in fact, what really happens is they sort of decided they had never existed there in the first place. That really, they had always, all the time, it had only existed here and here and here. And so that's, so now this should seem incredibly bizarre to you. And it is bizarre, and yet at the same time, it's the most natural thing in the world. And the reason I say it's the most natural thing in the world is that we physicists have known for the last 100 years or so that in fact nature really does behave according to these laws of quantum physics, which say this behavior is completely reasonable. But always, you know, up to this time, all these laws of strange laws of quantum physics had the decency to confine themselves to living deep inside its submicroscopic scales, where you could never see them really directly. You could sort of indirectly sense their presence and understand that they were really governing everything. But here we now have something on a human-sized scale that has these remarkable, you know, shows these remarkable laws of behavior of quantum physics. And that's really the, I think, fundamentally the reason this has made such an impact in physics, is that it gives physicists a way to really, now instead of indirectly studying this, they can now really very directly observe and manipulate these so-called quantum wave functions, right? And if I had explained that the little blob of condensate is really something called a quantum wave, then you know when you have two waves and you're combining them, at some places they cancel and other places they add up. And so waves, you know, adding two waves together, this behavior is completely reasonable. And so what we're doing is we're really directly working with quantum waves. And that's a lot of fun to physicists. And so this generated lots and lots of people doing experiments. They've used this approach to make Bose condensates now in quite a number of different atoms. All of the numbers on this are out of date because I got tired of updating them so frequently. But, you know, it sort of increases at 10% a month or so. So there's lots and lots of physicists studying all different kinds of atoms. They're, you know, this Bose condensate is a really fascinating new material with all these very strange properties. And so people have been measuring all these different properties. There are lots of theorists, you know, people who calculate things with computer and paper and pencil, predicting properties, predicting experiments you should do, trying to understand in terms of basic theory the observations that people have done. And so generating lots and lots of papers on this. I guess it's good for the Canadian economy because you make lots of paper, right? Anyway, this is, like I said, it's turned into a major field of physics. And I might also point out, this is something that, particularly for students who might be here, that there's a lesson here which often gets overlooked, which is that one pictures that often, in fact, scientists like to kind of generate the image is a scientist is sort of a brilliant loner, and there's some absolute standard of good science and bad science. But in fact, physics, like everything else, is fundamentally a social activity. And the real measure of what is good science is that a whole bunch of other scientists get interested and want to start working on that same area. And so, you know, this all this interest basically defined this as good physics. And so, you know, and you, that's lots of physicists working on what you want to do, that gets you to Stockholm. Does that mean I'm running over my time here? So this is the anniversary of Nobel's death when they give out the Nobel Prize. Maybe I can turn this even all the lights down so you can see the next a little better. Yeah, so here we are in Stockholm. Here Eric and I are in our funny costumes. And the royal family's here. I'll just mention, actually, that this was really a very special year, 2001, because it was the 100th anniversary of the Nobel Prizes. And so behind us, that year's winners are in the front row. Behind us are all the Nobel laureates who are still alive and well enough to travel, sitting back here. So if you have very sharp eyes, you can pick out all your favorite Nobel Prize winners back there. And here's the nice king giving me a medal and a nice check. So now, okay, so again, an aside to students here, just so you can be planning ahead. I didn't know this, but it turns out that the ceremony is not the big deal. The big deal in Sweden is the dinner you have after the ceremony with 2,000 of your closest friends and every important person in Sweden, and also all the old Nobel laureates here. And this really is quite a dinner, you know. It's got acts of opera in between courses and little things like that. And you can imagine it takes a while to finish. Okay, so that basically ends the first part of the talk. What I want to go on to now, though, is to give you a sense, a little bit of the flavor of the exciting science that's still coming out of this. And the emphasis is, like much of science, what you really try and do is be able to explore and measure and see how nature behaves under conditions that you've never been able to look before, you've never been able to produce before. And of course, the hope is always that you'll see strange new things happening. And by looking at those strange new things and thinking about them and understanding them, you then understand nature better, and that new knowledge applies in many other places, and that's sort of the way physics proceeds. And so I'm going to talk about something we've been doing recently with Bose condensates, where we've been discovering unexpected things, and it comes from controlling what we call controlling the self interactions. A little condensate is a little blob of stuff, and when one part of the condensate interacts, pushes or pulls on another part. And so if it's repulsive, then it sort of pushes it out and the condensate gets fatter. If it's attractive, it's pulling itself in, and you put more condensate atoms in there and it shrinks. Now, for about the first 5 years of studying condensates, people had each atom that people make a condensate in had just a particular interaction. And we did a bunch of work that allowed us to do experiments where we could control that interaction. So we could change it from being repulsive to attractive, or being a little bit repulsive to being very repulsive. And we could study how the system behaved. And so I'll give you one example of this, which gave a particularly dramatic. And in fact, we made it the forces so attractive that if you look at the equations that describe this condensate, the equations say that it's not even allowed to exist anymore. And so we wanted to ask, well, you know, so it's not allowed to exist, we're killing it off, but how do quantum wave, you know, these quantum wave functions, how do they really die when you try and kill them off? And so we made the condensate, so that's what you're looking at, it's a little picture here. We suddenly switch it to make it attractive. And for the first few thousandths of a second, it did what anyone would have guessed it would do, which is it's attractive, and so it's all just pulling in on itself. But then was the big shock, because then it exploded, okay? So then all this blue stuff here is is atoms kind of exploding out of this condensate. And so what you have is something that's actually very much like a supernova. If you remember, in a supernova, a star burns up a lot of its fuel, and then it starts collapsing in on itself, and then there's this gigantic explosion, and you're left with a little cold neutron, you know, dim neutron star left behind. We have exactly the same, shrinks in, explodes out here, and we're left with a little cold remnant condensate behind. And so we've named this the bosonova because of the similarities there. Now, you shouldn't take this similarity too seriously, because, you know, if nothing else, a supernova, as you probably know, is the most enormous, spectacular explosion mankind has ever observed. The bosonova is the most pathetic, tiny explosion ever anyone has ever seen. But it's still pretty exciting to us physicists. And the reason it's so exciting is we don't understand it. We don't understand that, you know, there's some fascinating new physics that's driving this explosion that determines how much energy this pathetic little explosion is, and it determines, and also we don't understand how this little remnant condensate survives, you know, which is a pretty small explosion by our standards, but compared to it, it's a very violent, nasty explosion, and how does this little piece survive that? So this is just an example, but we're sure we'll understand this, okay? I mean, we've got theorists busy working on this, calculating it, and they're clearly making progress. And before long, they will understand this, and then we'll understand nature a little better than we could before. And it's just, I wanted to kind of give you a flavor of how when you can put material in some completely new regime, there's still exotic, unexpected behavior out there to be discovered. And so that's what makes playing with these condensates so much fun. Okay, so let me just finish up here talking about what's next, or what really most everybody who's not a physicist is probably sitting there wondering is, yeah, okay, it keeps physicists happy, but is it actually good for anything? So I've talked about why it keeps physicists happy. It's, you know, it's really a new area of the quantum world we can explore. It's got surprises. We're learning more about basic quantum physics, and some of that behavior actually carries over fairly directly in thinking about issues that are important for building smaller wires and computer chips and so on. In terms of real uses of the condensate itself, I think first I want to emphasize that I think we're a number of years away from it, but I'm actually optimistic that it really will have some uses outside of the physics lab. And the reason I'm optimistic is because of the comparison between Bose condensates and lasers, light. When I have this laser beam here, the thing that makes this laser, really the only thing that makes it special and useful, is the fact that all the light is doing exactly the same thing. It's all exactly the same color going exactly the same direction. And it turns out that the Bose condensate is the exact atom analog of laser light, with all the atoms doing exactly the same thing. Now, because the laser light is all doing exactly the same thing, we can control that light much, much better than we can control normal light, like comes from a light bulb. And it's that very special control we have over laser light which makes it useful, and why it's, you know, it's used sending all your telephone signals now, you know, surgery, compact disc players. It's probably, you probably have a dozen lasers in your house you don't even know about now. And it's because of that very special control. And so now we have that very special control over atoms. And so I'm optimistic there really will be places where that control will be useful for applications. Some of those are actually being pretty vigorously developed right now. It turns out there are certain kind of detectors, very ultra-sensitive detectors, which this special atom control allows you to make better. Just for example, better atomic clocks, because you can control the atoms better. One that the U.S. military is putting a lot of money into is things that, actually the military and the oil industry, are things that these special instruments that measure gravitational fields very, very sensitively. And so I can check exactly how strong gravity is here, and then I can move over there and measure and detect tiny differences. It turns out that's very useful for several reasons. One is that you can use it to tell if there's a big pool of oil down there, which of course people really like to know. The other thing, and this is where the military comes in, is it tells you if there's a cave down there, which is something they're very anxious to know these days too. So anyway, there are these exotic measurement instruments that people are actually working right now on actually building, using Bose condensates for. But they're kind of special. I'm guardedly optimistic that 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, you'll actually be using condensates in much, the kind of application that might be in everybody's house. And that is, anybody who knows anything about modern technology knows we're making things tinier and tinier. And you don't have to make a great leap to imagine that it's not going to be too long before we really are working on building structures and machines and electronics, really assembling them one atom exactly where we want it at a time. And right now, Bose condensates are the only way you can get that, the sort of exquisite precision control of atoms. You're going to need to do that. Now, having said that, there's enormous engineering problems that have to be solved before that's going to be possible. But, I'm a physicist, I don't have to worry about that. I do think, like I say, because of this similarity to laser light, there's a reason to be optimistic that we really will see applications of these. But in the meantime, it's lots of fun for us physicists. And so with that, I'll wrap up. I'll just mention that if you want to go home and make your own Bose condensates, playing with these applets, that's all available online. There's another site that has a lot more things on other areas of physics that I've been working on. And I'm happy to take questions with one qualification. I see a number of PhD physicists in the audience here, and I give a lot of public lectures, and I know that if a PhD physicist leaps up with some highly technical question, that kind of ends the questions for the rest of the night. So my request is, if you've got a PhD in physics, save your questions for later, but I'd be happy to answer questions from the rest of you. Thank you. So the question is, he's pointing out how lasers have moved from very expensive, difficult things to get to very cheap, easy things to get, and he wants to know when Bose condensates you're going to have your Bose condensate pointer. The answer to that is, as soon as somebody comes up with a brilliant idea on how to make them a lot easier and simpler than what we're doing now. It took a number of years for the laser, and it looks like it's going to take a number of years for Bose condensates too. So, I can't predict, because I can assure you that the technology and the method we've demonstrated are not scalable down to simple, inexpensive things. So it needs some good ideas. Yeah.
You talk about atoms.
So the question is, what material do we make a Bose condensate out of? You can actually do it in a number of different atoms. The one we used first was rubidium, and then people have done it in sodium, lithium, hydrogen, bunch of other things, potassium. And we actually think you can do it in a great many atoms using this approach. Not all of them, and some are easier than others. It turns out, if you know some chemistry, you realize that almost all of these are that first column in the periodic table, the so-called alkali metals. And the simple answer to why we've done with them is they're easier to use. They're easier to laser cool. It's easier to get the right color light that you need for those atoms to laser cool. Yeah, in back there? Yeah. Yeah, you. Just turning around behind the wire. Yeah.
Can you actually see the explosion?
Can you actually see the explosion? Those images there, those were pictures taken during the explosion of the atoms going flying out. You can't see it with your naked eye. It's too small, basically. But we can see it on our TV cameras. Yeah.
You showed those beautiful peaks. And as you cool down, you get a nicer peak.
Yep.
So at about 50 nanokelvin, you get this beautiful peak.
Mm-hmm.
If
you go lower, what you really start doing is we tend to think of cutting things away, and you really start to let the condensate escape or just cut it away. And so you just get this just gets smaller and smaller and fewer. So you just it just starts shrinking. So basically, you know, up to here you're taking atoms with more energy out. By the time you go lower, you're starting to take the ones out of the very bottom. And so you don't want to do that. That's your sample that you like. So, yeah, way in back.
Sort of along the lines earlier, you mentioned the machinery and the technology for making the condensate getting cheaper. Is there a potential for your Bosonova to become exothermic, that you get more energy out than
No, I would say we're about a billion times away from that. So I can be pretty confident we're never going to get more energy out of it than we took to make it. So, yeah.
If there are 1,000 people working on this topic, how many of these machines are there?
I was trying to estimate that now, and I would guess there are about about 50 apparatuses around the world that are making Bose condensates now. It's hard to keep up with the numbers. I'm sure it's under 100, but it's and more than 40. So it's getting to be a pretty standard thing. So yeah. I'm not sure I understand. Okay, can you?
You're contemplating practical uses.
Yeah.
Absolute zero requires massive.
Right. Okay. Apparatus. Yeah. So the question is, he's asking. I talked about applications of these things, and he's saying, well, is it, can you? Can you contemplate really working at these very low temperatures in any kind of simple apparatus? The first thing I want to emphasize is, the heart of our apparatus is actually pretty small and doesn't have a lot of any of the traditional refrigeration stuff to it. And so these instruments where, superatomic clocks and super instruments that have, it's certainly, people are happy to make those things that are like this scale. That's certainly doable. a lot of the things where I was talking about building stuff with condensates, in fact, the atoms won't stay in a condensate. It's just the condensate in the same way that, you know, when you use a laser beam to do eye surgery or something, you know, once it's done, the light goes out of it, you know, isn't laser light anymore, but we'll just use it to lay the atoms, be able to control exactly where we put the atoms. Then they'll be warm again, but they'll have been positioned with this incredible precision. Okay, so it just kind of is a construction tool, if you like. Yes. Right, so anybody who's ever looked at, even in physics things, knows anything about very low temperature physics, it's gigantic, huge apparatus and big refrigerators and doers and so on. And the big appeal to me in getting into this was we didn't have to use any of that stuff. It's actually really quite amazing that you can have this little glass cell. And you can, it's at room temperature, and 1 centimeter away you have something that now our record is down to a couple billionths of a degree above absolute zero. And it's just, we hold it so gently, and we have it, and just the way it's prepared and held is so good at insulating against the heat that it just doesn't warm up. It's actually, I mean, you know, I built it. I'm still amazed that it worked that anywhere near that well. You know, you would have thought there'd be something that would come in. It's, yeah.
Where does the energy come from for the explosion?
That's really a good question. Let me know when you got the answer. That's one of the excitements. Now, we do know these atoms can turn into molecules, and so there's a potential for getting chemical energy of two rubidium atoms sticking for a molecule. We don't understand how that energy could be created in this process and manifested in as that explosion. So, you know, I see a potential source of, you know, energy. I just don't see how it ought to behave that way. So,
are the electrons moving differently?
No, the electrons are just like in regular old atoms. So, yeah.
That's sort of the lead up from your question. I was kind of interested to know if you see a correlation between this explosion and the idea of the Big Bang at the beginning.
No, it's just a coincidence that it has these. The question was, is there any connection between this and the Big Bang, the beginning of the universe, that the scales of energy and density and so on, they clearly have to be tremendously different physics. It's just kind of amusing to see the similarities more than I think any fundamental physics connection. Yes.
How does Einstein's prediction work without any quantum mechanics involved?
I'm not sure I understand, because Einstein's prediction was about what would happen, you know, what quantum mechanics would predict would happen. So, yeah, I mean, yes. Oh, yeah, okay, so the question is really, Einstein didn't like to use quantum mechanics. How is he making this quantum prediction? He did use quantum mechanics. It is a basic quantum effect, but what he really didn't like was when he started understanding the more full ramifications of the equations of quantum mechanics. And like I said here, he didn't really think through what the ramifications of this were. And if he had, based on his later work, he probably would have been somewhat unsettled by it, I would say. So, yeah, in front.
So Schrodinger's cat froze to death and the camera flash resurrected him?
Yeah, this. It. The reason is that. Sorry. Yes. So she's asking. Back when I was shining laser light on the atoms, why does it care so much about the color? Let me go back here. And why does the speed of the atoms care so much about the color of the laser light? The answer is that there's something called the Doppler shift. And what the Doppler shift does is if you're moving towards a beam of light, you see that light shifted in color actually to be bluer than it is. And if you're moving away from the light, you see the light shifted redder than it actually is. And so depending on what direction the laser beam is going and what direction the atom's going, the color of the laser light gets shifted in such a way that if it's opposing the motion, it bounces off the atoms much more. The atom sees it right at its favorite color and it bounces off it. Whereas if it happens to be moving away, it sees it shifted in color away from its favorite color and it doesn't bounce off it. Okay, so that makes it so, because of this Doppler shift, if you have it set right here, the direction, if it's moving towards it, they always get slowed down. The laser's coming from all directions, and so the atom really, it's the atom's motion that really determines which laser beam hits it, if you like, okay? Yes?
Is there any theoretical maximum to the size of the condensate?
Is there any theoretical maximum to the size of the condensate? There's no theoretical maximum. We have found a very practical maximum that the technique I showed, this evaporative cooling, what happens is that once you get up to more than about 10 million atoms, which is a pretty puny amount of atoms, but we can still see them without any trouble. What happens is you've got this cloud, and we want to let the most energetic ones get out. But it turns out that the energetic ones in the middle, they just keep running into other atoms and they never get out of the sample. And so you just can't cool a sample bigger than that using this approach. So again, this is something where we need a clever idea to figure out how to make much bigger samples. Okay. Who's next? Oh, yes. Yeah. So the question is the Bossa Nova explosion something to do with nuclear repulsion when they get in close together? The thing is, I didn't really talk about the scales. And one of the surprising things to us is that this happens when the atoms are still actually very, very far apart by any normal nuclear size scale. So we're sure it can't be anything like that because they're something like a million times too far apart for that.
What happens to the temperature during the Bossa Nova explosion?
Well, so the little remnant doesn't heat up very much. The other stuff goes flying out at a temperature that's 100 times hotter than it started out. So the question is, have we actually measured the energy from the Bossa Nova explosion? And yes, we've measured that quite precisely and studied in a lot of detail, actually, exactly what the energy is and how it changes as we change different conditions. And so that's one of the problems is we measured things so carefully that theorists have to get it exactly right or they can't publish papers, and it's hard for them to get things exactly right. They can't fudge anywhere. It's pretty easy. The way we actually measure all temperatures, which no one has asked yet, but I'm sure if I waited long enough, they would, because it's always a question. The way we measure the temperature of these things is we actually turn off the trap and we let the cloud fly apart, and we just measure exactly how fast all the atoms are going. And so in this Bozanova explosion, that's exactly what we've done here too, is we've actually turned this off. We measure how fast these atoms in the explosion are going, and that tells us what their temperatures are. And we found we can control that by changing the different parameters in the experiment. How many atoms you've started with, how big do you make the attraction, and so on. But the kind of energy scale of the explosion is that the original condensate sample is at about 3 billionths of a degree above absolute zero. This stuff comes exploding out with several hundred billionths of degree above absolute zero is the scale. The question is the remnant unchanged? And the answer is no. It's clearly changed, and it must be changed in more exotic ways, because it sort of violates a bunch of things we think should be happening. But the one thing we can see, then we need to study more about it, but it's quivering. It's oscillating like if you took a blob of gelatin and you whacked it. It sort of quivers back and forth like this and actually wiggles around. So it has been affected, but it hasn't been destroyed like we'd expect. So, yes. Yeah, so the question is, can we talk about this in relation to the zero-point energy field? In fact, I mean, so the zero-point energy field, I would put that in terms of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that if you get down to the lowest possible energy, there's still some energy left. It's because, and here it also means, it's just equivalent to saying but I won't try and explain why it's equivalent here, but it's also equivalent to saying you can't measure position and velocity precisely. And in fact, that goes into the shape of this peak here, because you see, if you went to absolutely zero energy in this bowl, you'd be perfectly concentrated down at the bottom. That would mean this peak here would have no width at all. It would be an infinite narrow spike, okay? And so the fact that it is spread out is really a direct manifestation of this. And if you've heard about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that you can't measure position and speed exactly right, I'll tell you that you can, if you know all the parameters that went into this experiment, you can take a ruler to this picture, and you can directly confirm this Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which is kind of remarkable, at least if you're a physicist. Think about it. Yeah. I'm sorry. No, all these atoms that we use, I mean, most of them are solids at room temperature, but we actually do all the cooling in a gas. So we evaporate a gas off of, you know, rubidium or sodium. So it's working. It's all of these things are done in a gas with the atoms a long ways apart. It's just, you know, you just take the solid and warm it up a little bit to get the gas off it. But since we need such tiny amounts of atoms, that's easily done. Should we cut things off here? Or?
Well, I think two more questions.
Okay, fine. Two more questions, and then. Yeah. Sorry, what? What was the pressure in our little cell, or? Yeah. So the pressure in the cell where we make these things is actually has to be extremely low, and that's to keep hot, warm atoms from bouncing in and warming things up. So it's about 10 to the minus 11 torr, which, you know, is 14 zeros less than sort of the air here. So very, very low pressure. Okay, last question. Yeah, so I'm not going to try and repeat the question. I'll just answer it. He's wondering, you know, we're going into the unknown. Are we worried about would we do bad things? The answer is, at some level, we're not going into the unknown at all. We're confirming a 70-year-old prediction and showing that physicists really know a remarkable amount. The other thing I should say on all of these things is, there's unknown and there's unknown. I mean, the things we see, we're sure can be explained within the traditional laws of physics, and they just, you know, applying them in this unusual regime. And so you can really set sort of very clear boundaries on whatever could possibly happen. So it's, you know, it's not, I'm describing them as exotic, but there's levels of exotic, and I think if you understand the basic physics, you really can be quite certain there's not going to be, you know, anything very science fiction-y coming out of this. So I'm actually happy to answer questions for a long time, but maybe people can come up, or there's a reception and you can talk to me there if you still have questions I didn't get to.
Perhaps so. People could come down if they have some extra questions. I'm going to ask Dr. Alan Schotter, who's the director of TRIUMPH, to thank our speaker. Right. Nice.